This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, September 26th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and the crisis in Puerto Rico continues.
The ports are closed. Of course, a lot of power outages, roads blocked by debris, water damage.
My cousin and I and our family still haven't been able to hear from all of our family over there, and we are concerned for them and for everyone on the island.
With power, other things are manageable. It's really one of our first priority, particularly in the hospitals, health clinics, and wastewater treatment plants.
Puerto Rico is hurting, and we need to be there and to let them know that the diaspora here in the United States, we are one with you.
And without power, then you potentially have issues with water.
We need to pay attention and to urgently support Puerto Rico and the Caribbean with donations and contributions.
You're listening to voices here on the mainland responding to the utter destruction left by Hurricane Maria. Some of those voices you might recognize, Jennifer Lopez and Rosie Perez, urging Americans on the mainland to remember their fellow Americans on the island. On Sunday night, Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rossello, pleaded for more federal support as large parts of his island struggle for the dire basics, food, water, and light. Meanwhile, San Juan's airport at one point began to resemble the chaos and the horror of the Louisiana Superdome after Katrina. The president tweeted about Puerto Rico last night, mostly focused on the island's broken infrastructure and massive debt. And today, the president announced he would visit Puerto Rico next Tuesday to survey the damage. Meanwhile, the National Guard, the Navy, and the Marine Corps have deployed aid to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands in recovery. And on Monday, Florida Senator Marco Rubio and representatives from FEMA and Homeland Security visited Puerto Rico to look at the damage. David Begno is a CBS News correspondent. He's been on the ground in San Juan.
The governor is telling us that military helicopters are now being used to distribute aid to some of the hardest hit areas. But here's what we actually saw beyond that statement from the governor. The governor got on a helicopter and he brought a satellite phone to the mayor in the town of San Sebastian. Satellite phones are becoming critical here on the island because the communication infrastructure is decimated. So the only way for senior officials in the government here to communicate with local mayors on the ground is with a satellite phone. Because when we asked the governor about various areas, he tells us, well, the last time I was there, they told me this. Well, the last time I was there, that's the only way they had to communicate. So the governor personally brought a cell phone to this mayor. Now, we have been asking the governor, will you take us and show us where the aid is being delivered? FEMA is tweeting photos of relief aid that's on the ground. But when the FEMA administrator spoke at a podium yesterday, he complimented the work of the governor complimented FEMA, and they both complimented the president. But the FEMA administrator took no questions. He left. Took no questions. So what we have said to the governor is, we want to see where the aid is being delivered. Will you show us? He said yes, and we plan to hold him to it.
David, tell me what you saw when you were in the airport in San Juan yesterday.
It was dire. There were probably more than 1,000 people standing in line, kids that had been stripped naked by their parents who were sleeping in strollers, sweating as their parents fanned them with cardboard. The people were desperate there. These were Americans who were trying to get off the island. Some of them are tourists, but others are people who've evacuated their home and are trying to leave. They're hoping to get out on any flight. They're willing to pay, by the way. They're not looking for a free ride out of town. They're willing to pay. Some people had been at the airport for more than 3 days, sitting on the ground. There were no cots. No snacks were being handed out. So I went to the governor and I said, we saw a dire situation at the airport. And he said, we're going to send supplies there. We're going to send at least water and some snacks. And he made good on his word. We were there when supplies arrived. Now, the situation got a little bit better as the day went on, but people were saying, I'm coming back, because the airport was telling people, go home, go to wherever you were, and then come back to the airport. So what we're seeing is, in the morning, it's the worst. You have the most amount of people trying to get on the flights with really no answers as to whether they're going to be able to get out. And then it dwindles throughout the day, settles down a little bit, and then ramps back up the next morning. The airlines are not able to get as many flights in as they want. Here's why. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, has told CBS News that there was a transmission tower that was destroyed in the hurricane, and that limited the radar that commercial pilots need in order to land commercial planes here. So the planes that are coming in It's only one or two a day, and they're bringing relief supplies. And when they leave, they're taking people out on those relief flights. That's the situation right now.
David, in terms of rescues, before we let you go, there have been many, many reports, but one report in particular of a high-rise building, I think in San Juan, 14 or 15 stories high, filled with elderly people, many without food or water. When rescue workers had discovered them, many had not eaten for days. Many were bewildered. What do you know about that building and what's happened to the people who live there?
I know nothing about that report, but let me say this. Confirming individual reports like that are extremely tough. Most of the time, the only way we can confirm information like that is if we get the governor in person and we ask him directly. Getting in touch with his staff is difficult, not because they're giving us the runaround, but because making a phone call around here or checking an email is exceptionally hard. I'll tell you this about rescues. The governor says they are still going on 6 days after the hurricane in areas where some rescuers have not even been able to reach. Let me clarify. They've been able to reach it and see that people need help, but they haven't been able to get the rescuers in there to pull them out.
And next steps for FEMA?
Next steps for FEMA, we'd love to know. The administrator stood at the podium for less than 5 minutes and said they have a difficult challenge ahead, but they are up to it. We just want to know specifics. Where is the aid going? Will you allow us to show the American people it actually being delivered in a distribution line? I've got people messaging me, probably 30 people a minute, saying my family needs help, my family needs water, my family needs to eat. We are just asking FEMA to show us the work that they're doing. It's not that we don't believe what they're saying, but show us.
David Begnaud, CBS News. Thanks for the time.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Meanwhile, the island's already fragile economy is going to experience even more strain. Puerto Rico is suffocated under at least $70 billion in debt, and the economy's been in a recession since 2006. Justin Velez-Hagan is founder and executive director of the National Puerto Rican Chamber of Commerce, and he joins me now. Justin, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Take a moment, if you would, and describe the economy of Puerto Rico. It's a place with 40% poverty, which is extremely high. What does Maria mean to those figures?
Unfortunately, Puerto Rico's economy has already been pretty poor. They've been in a recession for at least a decade. And of course, that puts it in the category of a depression at that point. Unemployment is very high. The poverty rate, like you just mentioned, is double that of the poorest state in the country. So any kind of economic damage or anything that could potentially hurt the economy of Puerto Rico is just devastating to the outlook as of right now. Puerto Rico has been trying very hard. Obviously, they're deeply indebted territory. They've been trying very hard to overcome that, make some amends and turn the corner of their economy. But this sort of disaster obviously doesn't help things.
Tourism is, of course, extremely important to the island. But I saw one figure that said that 80% of the economy in Puerto Rico is small businesses.
Absolutely. You're right. And some of that's tied to tourism, of course. Small businesses doing anything from renting jet skis or selling to the tourists that come in. But that's right.
What does that economy look like to you when you look around and see the pictures and the recovery that's in store for the island in terms of people's ability to work?
It just looks like small businesses are wiped out to me. I've got faith that people are going to survive and persevere, but right now, they don't have cash. There's no way to get money. There's no way to transfer funds. You can't go to an ATM as of now if you don't have power, of course. And if you have a small business that accepts credit cards or debit cards, that isn't operable at the time. So without access to cash, how can businesses even operate? So right now, businesses are kind of standing by, hoping the power comes back on. And this is anywhere from the smallest of small businesses, small vendors on the street, to small restaurants, to businesses like Walgreens. I've got a friend, actually, who is telling me about his experience going to Walgreens, wanted to buy some water or some kind of goods, and he just couldn't make the transaction because he didn't have cash. So you kind of have just an incredible, indeterminate amount of economic stall because of the lack of power and every other thing tied to the disaster here.
Puerto Rico is already a place where people leave. There are millions more Puerto Ricans on the mainland than the 3.5 million who live on the island already. We've had experts and leaders in Puerto Rico warn what happens if there's a massive flight of Puerto Rican American citizens to the mainland now. Do you expect that to happen? And what would happen?
I think there's a lot of people that have been withholding moving away from the island because they kind of have, again, a little glimmer of hope, hoping that the economy will turn the corner. But certainly something like this probably is, I would say, the straw that broke the camel's back to a lot of people. So if you have a population that's shrinking by 2 to 3% every year, I would imagine that at least this year in the short term, that's going to increase. And the people that are leaving, even if they are considering their exodus as a temporary one, maybe going to live with family for a few months or something, you know, once you come to the mainland, you find another opportunity, the chances of coming back are probably slimmer than you might anticipate. And the other issue with the people that are leaving is the people that are leaving are the ones that have money to leave, that have economic opportunities somewhere else. They might be young professionals or business people or doctors, and unfortunately, they're the ones that produce an economy the most and have the most to contribute, and they're kind of leaving in droves already. And so you add this crisis to it, and it's really not going to help things at all, that's for sure.
Well, what does that do to the economy they leave behind on the island?
I think that you can kind of wipe out the potential for economic growth this year, potentially stall the potential for the next couple of years, or at least put off the turnaround in the near future. I think 2 to 3 years at least is kind of what is my best case scenario, I guess, about how the economy may be affected. You figure if Puerto Rico is already shrinking, they already have a poor economy that's shrinking, anything, even a 1% hit to the GDP is going to be substantial, put them into an even deeper recession. Now you're looking at something that's probably going to hit them much harder than that. It could be 5% hit to GDP or something, maybe even greater this year. So we'll see. It could be pretty disastrous.
And as we step back from that situation and some of those dire numbers that you're talking about, Justin Velez-Hagan, Puerto Rico is already in a debt crisis of about $70 billion. Congress has been hard at work debating, arguing, trying to restructure that debt. With this devastation threatening the future ability of Puerto Rico to make money, what's the outlook?
I think that all the negotiators, first of all, are going to come back to the drawing table. I know there's, and to take a step back, they've had a long negotiation process. Puerto Rico has a fiscal oversight board that has been trying to implement certain austerity measures to get Puerto Rico back on track and be able to pay back its debt. Right now, all of the suppositions that were relied on to make those decisions and to make any assessment about Puerto Rico's future economy are basically out the window. So they had to start over and reassess what the potential is for Puerto Rico to make any payments back to its creditors. And that's very unfortunate for their future economy and future potential growth, because they can't borrow money. They won't be able to invest in infrastructure. It doesn't look good on kind of all sides.
Yeah. Well, there are opportunities everywhere, Justin Velez-Hagan, and you're the leader of the National Puerto Rican Chamber of Commerce. What's the best investment opportunity in Puerto Rico right now?
It's tough to say. There's a lot of damage, and I hate to be so flippant about the investment possibilities in real estate, but obviously the real estate market has been very, very good for investment, looked very, very positive, and there's always going to be a strong tourism industry because it's a beautiful place to visit, but they have significant tax advantages and incentives for any businesses of any size, especially exporters. So probably have a lot of investment from the federal government, so things will return back to normalcy soon enough. So I think it'll still be a good investment in the long term.
Justin Velez-Hagan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Justin Velez-Hagan is founder and executive director of the National Puerto Rican Chamber of Commerce.
The Takeaway is supported by Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.
If you want a hearing, you better shut up.
Those are protesters at a hearing in the Senate Finance Committee yesterday. And as chairman, Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, people did not shut up. 181 of them arrested, according to the U.S. Capitol Police, protesting Senate Republicans' latest try at repealing the Affordable Care Act, the bill known as Graham Cassidy. By the end of the day, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine announced she would not support the bill. She was the third Republican to say so. Republicans can only lose two, and that means repeal, again, is likely dead. With the latest from Capitol Hill is Jennifer Habercorn, senior healthcare reporter for Politico. Jennifer, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
So is Graham Cassidy dead, Jennifer?
It's all but dead. I mean, we can't say that it's never going to come back to life, because certainly Republicans have tried Obamacare before, and when we thought it was dead, they've brought it back. But this is very, very bad for Republicans right now. It's nearly impossible to see how they can resurrect this.
So what happened here? There was a partial CBO score, Congressional Budget Office score yesterday, that said Graham Cassidy would reduce healthcare spending by $1 trillion over 10 years and that millions of people would lose coverage. Was that the death knell?
No, I don't think that was it. I mean, we had Senator John McCain on Friday came out against the bill. That was kind of a surprise that he came out against it so early. He opposed the last effort. And Senator Rand Paul was already against it. And we kind of knew that Susan Collins, a moderate Republican who has always been skeptical of repealing Obamacare, that she was going to come out as a likely no eventually, and she just waited until that CBO score came out to do so. But the obituary was kind of written when John McCain came out against it, because they really would have needed his vote if they were going to keep it to just two Republicans to oppose it.
There were all these flourishes in the last few days that we saw. More money for Susan Collins' constituents in Maine. More money for constituents in Alaska, for Lisa Murkowski, who was also wavering. Potentially more money for others as well. That kind of deal-making didn't work here.
It didn't. And, you know, I think for Republicans, I mean, this keeps coming back because so many of them had made a campaign promise to repeal Obamacare. But when it came down to it, I don't think any amount of money would have convinced them. And you're dealing with very particular personalities. I mean, Senator Rand Paul, he said in a tweet just on Monday that he won't be bribed. And Lisa Murkowski has kind of done the same thing. Both of them can be very independent-minded lawmakers, and I don't think any amount of money for their state would have done anything. Even Lisa Murkowski said, you know, if you make this so Alaska is booming and the rest of the country is awful, that just means the system's going to collapse in a couple years. So that deal making really wasn't going to be the thing that brought this all together.
Still, when we step back from this, Jen Habercorn, and you look at the last 8 years of Republican politics, repealing Obamacare, as we know, has been job number one. They ran three elections on it. President Trump ran on it over and over again. They've tried, I'm counting, four, perhaps five times since last spring on repeal in earnest. What does this say?
I'm thinking about this. I've covered this healthcare law for 8 years. This is the most safe the law has ever been, because it didn't survive all these campaign promises. You know, there were Supreme Court cases. There were efforts to defund the law. Republicans had their chance. They have a president in the White House. They have full control of Congress. If they weren't able to do it now, it's really hard to see how they were ever going to be able to do it.
There are bipartisan talks behind the scenes going on between senators to see if they can pass some fixes to Obamacare. And we'll see in the coming weeks whether those talks gain any energy now that repeal appears, for this time, to be dead. Jen Habercorn, Politico, thanks for being here.
Great to talk with you, Todd.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. While Congress argues about health care and insurance and hospital visits, one issue that's not getting a lot of attention is dental care. Roughly 50 million Americans live in places where it's difficult to see a dentist. And even for those that do, dental pricing and insurance is a complicated web of exceptions and state laws that leave about one-third of Americans with barriers to proper care. So journalist Mary Otto traveled around the country to see the state of America's teeth. She wrote about it in a new book. It's called Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America.
I've found many stories in many places across the country, and there were shortage areas, communities that have lacked dentists for years, where people end up resorting to emergency rooms or to waiting in long lines and sleeping in their cars, hoping for free care at these temporary field hospital type clinics that are set up. I found inner city children who had lacked routine dental care. I got started on this when I met a boy who turned out to be dying of complications from an abscess tooth back in 2007, and roughly a third of Americans face significant barriers just getting the most routine kinds of dental care.
So where is this breaking down? Is it strictly an issue of ability to pay? It sounds like it's not strictly a rural-urban divide, or is it?
No, it's not. There are many places that the system breaks down. many people don't have the ability to pay out of pocket for dental care. Over 100 million Americans lack any kind of dental benefits. The beneficiaries of Medicaid entitles children to care, but fewer than half of Medicaid children get dental care, and fewer than half of dentists participate. Medicaid doesn't entitle poor adults to dental care. It depends on the state. Medicare, which covers over 50 million retired Americans, has never included routine dental benefits. So people wait until they're suffering and in so much pain they go to an emergency room. Very seldom do they find the dental care they need in an emergency room. They usually get a painkiller and an antibiotic, and they're told to go see their dentist. But roughly 50 million Americans live in communities where there aren't enough dentists to serve them.
What are some of the physical health consequences of poor dental care?
Well, there's the pain, of course, which really prevents people from studying and working. If you're missing your teeth, you can lose out on job opportunities. A survey by the American Dental Association a couple years ago found that one-third of low-income Americans are reluctant to smile. Then, of course, there are the serious health consequences, like this 12-year-old boy I met named Diamante Driver in Maryland who died of, you know, this abscess tooth that resulted in complications that took his life. So, yeah, there are many, many consequences to poor oral health.
What's the solution in your estimation, Mary Otto? Is it more funding through Medicaid or state programs to get more dentists in underserved areas since so many of these people are low income?
Of course, that would help. Also, there's some very innovative programs going on with school-based clinics and getting care out to senior centers, nursing homes, and schools, not always with the use of dentists, but with the use of dental hygienists and other kinds of dental workers to just get this kind of routine screenings and preventive services that are inexpensive and get the people with more urgent needs into a dental office or a clinic somewhere where they can get their more serious needs taken care of.
Mary Otto, thank you for joining me.
Todd, thank you so much for listening.
Mary Otto is author of Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America.
When I was putting together my first book, I did a stretch in Washington as a newspaper correspondent. And every day I went over to the Congress, that grand old benevolent national asylum for the helpless. And I reported on the inmates there.
That was Mark Twain speaking to a crowd in 1967. Well, actually, it was Hal Holbrook playing Mark Twain in 1967. Last month, Holbrook played his legendary one-man role for the last time. But it wasn't Hal Holbrook that turned Mark Twain into an American legend. It was the stories and the books. And this week, a new addendum is being added to Twain's history, thanks to a Twain scholar named John Bird, who stumbled upon an undiscovered Twain story.
The thing about the manuscript that really took his breath away, there was a little scribbled note with editorial suggestions from Twain's daughter, Susie. And that was the moment when Bird got chills down his spine and realized he was reading what was probably a description of a story Twain had actually told his little girls.
That's Mythili Rao, a producer for the New Yorker Radio Hour. She recently wrote for the New Yorker about Twain's unpublished story. It's called The Purloining of Prince Oleomargarine. Today, Twain's story is being published by Penguin Random House. The book lists Mark Twain as an author on the cover, but he also has two collaborators, Philip and Aaron Stead. Now, the Steads took some liberties in finishing this story, including making the main character black, and that's generated even more buzz around Mark Twain's posthumous publication.
The manuscript that Twain left is 16 pages long, and it kind of ends in the middle of the story. It's also, I mean, I'm calling it a manuscript, but it's really notes. These are fragments, kind of plot points, some descriptions, but there's a lot that's missing. The Steads are award-winning children's author illustrators, and they were brought on to turn these fragments into a real story. They were nervous about taking on the project because Mark Twain is such a beloved icon, and they knew they were going to have to make some choices kind of on his behalf and were worried about getting it right.
Let's listen to co-author Philip Stead talking about, in a way, collaborating with Mark Twain.
Delving too far into his catalog, it doesn't take you very long to start getting the heebie-jeebies about something that he'll have said. And he's so tricky because he can on one page seem progressive well beyond his years. And then the very next page, he'll say something that just makes you smack yourself in the forehead and say, I can't work with this guy.
But Philip Stead did work with this guy.
Yeah. So to get in the mindset of writing a Twain story, what Philip did and what he's talking about there, he read two of the three volumes of Twain's gigantic autobiography. And it gave him a sense of Twain's voice, but there were also things in there that troubled him. You know, some of his politics were really at odds with what the Steads felt was important to put in a book that's being published in 2017. I think the biggest choice that the Steads made, and maybe the boldest choice they made, was to make the protagonist of this story, Johnny, black. And that's not something that was explicitly mentioned anywhere in the manuscript.
And that's a choice that has turned out to be very controversial, especially in the context of Mark Twain's anthology and his career, his authorship of Huckleberry Finn, one of the most important novels in American history and one of the most important novels about race. Here's Erin Stead, the illustrator, talking about her decision to make Johnny black.
In truth, the most honest answer is that it's just the way I saw him from the beginning. But also, the truth is that, you know, you have all these fairy tales, and it's in the fairy tales we know you see a lot of little blonde girls running around, and with this one, I wanted it to be different.
Mythalie, was this problematic for people? She's right that a lot of fairy tales, traditional fairy tales, have little blonde girls running around. On the other hand, one does not necessarily take liberties with one of the greatest American authors of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Stead's decision to make Johnny black came from a very honest place creatively. And, you know, the point that Erin makes about blonde girls running around in the fairy tales we know is a real one. The Cooperative Children's Book Center at the University of Wisconsin in Madison keeps stats every year on the number of books that are published that feature non-white characters. And in 2016, the number of books that are about black children or black characters, it's still only 8% of the 3,000-some books that are published in the U.S. every year. So, you know, this is a real issue that there just aren't black faces in many children's books. And I think the Steads are right to want to change that.
Well, I mean, Mark Twain never shied away from issues of race at all. In fact, he dealt with them head on in more than one book. And one of the arguments here is that if Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, had wanted Johnny to be black, well, he would have done it. He would have made him black.
That's exactly what several Twain scholars told me, that Twain was never shy about these things. So one of the Twain scholars I spoke with did say, you know, it is plausible to think that Twain could have had a black character. The question is this character in this book a good representation of how Twain may have thought of a black character?
Right. Well, you spoke with David Bradley Jr., who's a novelist and essayist, about this very question.
The whole conjunction of Mark Twain and anything racial is politically loaded. Was he a racist? Wasn't he a racist? And it's sort of amusing because he is such a figure. That question isn't asked about most other writers, American writers. And I think the reason is because Twain actually did something about race, and most of them didn't.
That's David Bradley Jr., who is African-American, sort of making the point that Mark Twain was interested in race his whole life. He wasn't shy about it. And if he wanted to address race in a story, well, he would have.
Bradley felt strongly about that. And, you know, a little skeptical, to be honest, of the publisher's motives in making a character black where there wasn't any historical record for it.
Well, Mythalie, you know, we've covered in the past undiscovered books from famous authors. I have to say, at times, it's exciting when they're discovered and then the story's maybe not that great. There might be a reason they never published it. Is this one good?
This book has gotten terrific reviews. And, you know, one thing that's interesting about it is, like, it clearly grew out of a story that Twain was telling his daughters. But the book that is being published is something more complicated. Mark Twain is a character in it. Philip Stead, one of the authors, is a character in it. They have a conversation about the story. They argue about the story. There are a lot of layers there. And so I can't yet imagine reading it to my young son, but I'm curious about how actual kids will respond to it. And if it brings them closer to Mark Twain and gets them excited about Mark Twain, I think that's exactly what the folks who originally found this manuscript would be excited about.
The sort of new children's book is called The Purloining of Prince Oleomargarine. The authors are Philip Stead, Erin Stead, and a brand new author on the American scene, Mark Twain. Mythili Rao is a producer at the New Yorker Radio Hour at WNYC. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Todd.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.
This is Lisa from Portland, Oregon. In 2017, patriotism means standing against a president who doesn't understand what the Constitution is all about.
My name's Noah, and I'm calling from Evanston, Illinois. In 2017, patriotism means loving your country without being blind to its flaws. A true patriot is able to see their country's potential and is willing to take a stand against the people and ideas that hold their nation back.
This is Damaris Morrill from St. Louis. Patriotism in 2017 means supporting a symbol rather than caring for a fellow American, a living, breathing human being. I live in St. Louis, and during the protests, people were burning the American flag. And on social media, fellow St. Louisans were saying that the people should be beaten and thrown in jail. It's troubling that we tolerate the suffering of human life much more than taking a knee or burning a piece of cloth.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Just some of the calls from you reacting to demonstrations over the weekend in the NFL. Players, and in some cases coaches, taking a knee to protest racial inequality and police brutality against people of color. Protests like these in sports aren't new. In 1967, Muhammad Ali refused to step forward for the army draft and fight in a war he couldn't support.
I will not go 10,000 miles from here to help murder and kill another poor people simply to continue the domination of white slave masters over the darker people of the earth.
Ali lost his title and his living, and here's the part that people forget, became one of the most hated people in America. Massive majorities of white people considered Ali unpatriotic. Ali himself, un-American. When he died last year, presidents attended his funeral. Now in 2017, protests in the NFL are replaying this story. Players are taking a knee, and some are questioning their patriotism. The president is rallying his political base against those protesters, against the league, and against the idea of the protests themselves. So what does it mean to be patriotic? Is it for everyone? We're going to explore that question all this week with a variety of voices and perspectives here on The Takeaway. We begin with Terrell Germaine Starr. He's a staff writer for The Root, whose recent article is called Patriotism is for White People. He begins with his reaction to the NFL protests and owner Jerry Jones kneeling last night with the Dallas Cowboys.
Every once in a while, athletes, particularly black athletes, have to tell the viewing audiences that they're actually human beings. And so once they decide to take a break from entertaining people and deciding to say that, you know, once I leave this field or once I leave this basketball court or once I leave the sports arena, I become a human being who's no longer superhuman, but someone who's eligible, whose skin tone is eligible to participate in white supremacy, being a victim of it, that is, then there's a pushback on it because you're forcing people to think about issues, number one, that don't concern them. Well, it should concern them, but they think it doesn't. And then, two, they don't want to talk about it. But in regards to Jerry Jones kneeling before the national anthem, it's pretty much hypocrisy. It makes me wonder, what are they kneeling for? It also makes me wonder why, if you're kneeling for something, if you're upset with Donald Trump, then why did you, you know, what was it that made you kneel? And it wasn't Kaepernick, that wasn't enough for you. It wasn't enough that Trump insulted people on a regular basis. So it was really a hypocritical stance as far as I'm concerned.
You wrote yesterday in The Root that patriotism is for white people.
Mm-hmm.
Forget about the flag and saluting and pledges of allegiance for mm-hmm. a second. What did you mean by that?
Basically, no one has really, a few of us have taken time to interrogate exactly what the word patriot means. What was the genesis of that word? Who was the first person who used it? Who has been able to benefit from expressing patriotism? And based on my reading and understanding of it is that first, it's often ascribed to people who fight for America and its military forces. And let's say if the person comes back from any fight, right, it was normally white men, and you come back to America, and the goal and the thinking is that you are able to enjoy the freedoms that you have because people fight to protect the country from invasion, and you can live in your liberty. The reality is that black people have never been able to fully exercise their liberties as human beings, especially in comparison to white people. And so I don't think that the word was ever designed to include us because we are not fully experiencing the liberty of America.
Does that mean that you can love your country and be non-patriotic at the same time, or you can't really love it because you can't participate fully?
I think that we can love our country. I just don't believe that specific word is meant for black people. I certainly do not call myself patriotic simply because of my understanding of the word. Patriot means white. Patriot means someone, the benefits of being an American citizen in regards to being full-blooded American, that's something that's ascribed to white people. And another thing, too, the beginning of this country is pretty much based on white supremacy. It's based on colonialism. And I don't necessarily look at the American armed forces, particularly in a positive light. They are a colonizing force. The military in America is often taught that it protects America, and it does, but it's also one that invades countries through its foreign, through American foreign policy unfairly. It's one that is used to threaten. And so if you look at America as the colonial white supremacist state that it is, then you're going to have to look at the other qualifiers that define it. And patriotism is part of it, because if black Americans were truly considered patriotic, then many Americans would not be so upset with Kaepernick kneeling, because what he's saying is that because I am black, because of police brutality, because of racism and structural social injustice, I am not able to participate in the liberty that patriotism allows to all Americans.
But wasn't someone like Ali the greatest patriot? I mean, refused to step forward mm-hmm. for a war, hated by almost all of white Americans, not all, but almost all. Helped show this country the sin of the Vietnam War. And when he died, of course, one of the most celebrated Americans. And as I said, presidents came to his funeral. Now, that's not the measure of patriotism, but the lessons that he brought to this country through protest makes him one of the greatest patriots, or one could say that.
Oh, absolutely, one could say that. They could say that now, okay? If I wonder if those presidents who arrived at his funeral when he died would have supported him back when he was the bombastic Muhammad Ali that he was. And I would be willing to bet no. I'm pretty sure they would have hated his guts, right? So it's kind of like Kaepernick, right? People want to keep a distance with themselves with Kaepernick. And so people hate Kaepernick right now. And so maybe 50 years from now, when you make the sacrifice, when you're removed from the stressors and the racial anxieties and the frustrations and the angers, then, there's a way that distance and time allows you to kind of Santa Claus a person. But would these presidents really appreciate and engage Muhammad Ali that we knew back when he refused to join the army? Definitely not. And so his patriotism is kind of seen through this lens of revisionism.
Terrell Jermaine Starr is a staff writer at The Root. You can read his most recent piece, Patriotism is for White People.
This is Kit Dobry calling from Pooler, Georgia, and I think being truly patriotic means doing all we can to fulfill the promises made to all Americans in our Constitution.
What are those promises to you? We want to hear your take on patriotism and what it means in America in 2017. You can tell us, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.